This past Monday was Memorial Day, which has its roots in the years immediately following the Civil War. And it's the national holiday that has evolved over time into a day set aside to remember those who died while serving in our nation's armed forces. I happened to run across a Memorial Day reflection on Monday that included not only a reminder to give thanks for the lives of those who died in uniform, but also it incorporated a prayer for the wisdom not to go to war unnecessarily for the sake of soldiers who will be buried and remembered on future memorial days. And I thought that was an interesting way to orient Memorial Day not only to the past, but also to the future, without conflating it with Veterans Day or Armed Forces the way that a lot of people do. And it was a way to keep the main thing, while inviting serious reflection about how such a day might influence us down the road. And you see that kind of principle at work within the Bible all the time. And I want to say more about that in a moment. But first, I want to tell you a story about one of my distant cousins named Milton Willard, who was executed in 1864 in Petersburg, Virginia, for being a Union sympathizer. Along with many other men, he had tried to reach the federal lines, but he was captured. And then, knowing his fate, he escaped and tried to make his way back to see his family back home in North Carolina before he was captured again. And Milton's sister wrote a letter to the commanding officer begging for mercy, which arrived in Petersburg too late. But the officer did reply to her, telling her that her brother had already been shot, but that he would do anything he could to help her if she made the decision to come there, even though she was a stranger to him. That's the language that he used. And he closed by writing these words. He said, "Times is hard here, and they are shooting lots of men. I hope that this unmerciful war will soon stop." And before he was killed, Milton sent home two letters to his wife Mary, together with a New Testament that he carried with him. And on the inside of the New Testament, he wrote a message saying goodbye to their three young children. In his second letter to his wife, he asked her to raise them in the fear of the Lord, according to the teachings of the Quaker Church, quote, "for they are the best of all saints," end quote. And the first letter to his wife began with these grief-laden words. He wrote, "I have found out my doom, and it is death, I suppose. This is the last Sabbath I am ever to see on this earth, but I hope I am going where Sabbath will never end. And I hope you and my dear children may meet me, never more to part." Sabbath is meant to be a gift from God to his people. It's a day of rest after 6 days of working that runs from sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday. And it reflects the story of creation, the seven-day story of creation at the beginning of the Bible. Milton was looking ahead to his eternal rest. Although he wrote that first letter not on a Saturday, but on a Sunday. When Christians reflected on the resurrection of Jesus, which took place early on a Sunday, they saw it as the eighth day of creation. So Sunday for them wasn't the beginning of a new week, it was a continuation of creation. And so Christians eventually began to observe the Sabbath on Sunday rather than Saturday. Now, much later, we improved God's gift to us by adding a second day to the weekend and making that day of rest not something we get to do, but something we have to do through all kinds of blue laws that a lot of you grew up with in different towns in America. When I lived in Connecticut in the 1990s, I wasn't surprised that the sale of alcohol was forbidden on Sundays, but I was surprised to see the heavy canvas tarps that covered the shelves in the grocery store that had alcoholic beverages. And there were these letters stenciled on the tarp that made it look like the U.S. military had come in there and put up these tarps, just like the good Lord intended, I'm sure. And it was as though we mere mortals were in danger of melting like the Nazis at the end of the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark if our eyes were even to glimpse what was on these shelves on the Lord's Day. So those kind of laws didn't happen just in the South. They happened in Connecticut, too. I'm told that they took away that law in Minnesota last year, but you still can't buy a car on Sunday in Minnesota. So I'm sure that's helping. Sabbath, of course, is the theme of today's readings from the book of Deuteronomy in the Old Testament and the Gospel of Mark in the New Testament. I love this image of Jesus in Mark's Gospel as he walks with his disciples through a field of grain, and along the way, I can sort of see the breeze going and the grain waving, and along the way they start plucking the heads of grain. And folks who were super religious saw the whole thing unfold, and they said, "Aha! They're not supposed to do that. They're not honoring the Sabbath. They're not resting. They're working." Well, you know, at least we can thank God that people in the church are never like the Pharisees. Well, that's not true. We are like the Pharisees. We argue over all kinds of other types of religiosity. And when you hear this confrontation between Jesus and the Pharisees, it's really too easy to turn this whole scene into a rejection of the past, that somehow Jesus just shuts the door on the past and he begins something new. But what we're really watching here is an argument about the interpretation of a commandment. What does it mean in terms of how we live our lives today? And that kind of debate is something that's always been a part of and continues to be a part of the rabbinic tradition in Judaism. There are narrow ways of interpreting the law, and there are very generous ways of doing that. And with respect to the meaning of the Sabbath, Jesus and subsequently Christianity falls on the generous side of interpretation. And that's in spite of the crazy ways we've tried to legislate behavior around the Sabbath. And Jesus does the same thing in his most famous parable, his most famous story about the Good Samaritan, expanding widely the answer to the question, "Who is my neighbor?" In other cases, however, most notably in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus strengthens the law. He surprisingly makes it more strict, and then even more surprisingly drives us to a generous understanding of God's unlimited forgiveness, his unlimited mercy, his unlimited grace whenever we fail to live it. And I think all of those things come together in these Sabbath controversies that litter the pages of the Gospels. Jesus, it seems to me, wants us to experience the generosity of God and the gift of the Sabbath in a way that overflows in generosity toward our neighbors. And the Old Testament actually sets that trajectory in motion long before the birth of Jesus. The book of Exodus, where we first read about keeping the Sabbath as part of the Ten Commandments, roots it in creation. And that's how we usually think about the Sabbath, again, reflecting the story of creation. The Ten Commandments then appear again, as we heard today, in the book of Deuteronomy. Only this time, the commandment to take a day of rest is rooted not in creation, but in the experience of having lived in bondage in Egypt. "Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." So don't treat other people the way that you were treated, including the immigrants who cut your grass and clean your houses. Give people a break. You weren't given a break. There's a generosity that opens up to the world around us, an opening up of the Sabbath commandment, so that the emphasis is not just on God, but also on our neighbors, even those who are strangers among us. And it's like that prayer that recognizes the roots of Memorial Day in the past, but reorients it toward the future as well. It doesn't take away from the original meaning, it just expands it. To use a different example, is ancient Israel's biblical calling as a holy people meant to set themselves fully apart and withdraw from the world? That's one answer to the question. Or to be a light to the nations, blessing all the peoples of the earth? And that's a different answer to the question. And Christianity is a resounding affirmation of the latter. Except when Christians inside the church pull out a can of WD-40 to loosen the gates of righteousness in order to close them real tight. And we see that happen all the time. We've experienced that all the time. So Sometimes we've been the people pulling the gates closed. And yet Jesus loves us, even when, especially when, we mess things up. And the only remnant of his generous gospel we can find is preserved in an AA meeting in the church basement. The good news of his acceptance and his grace will never go away. No matter how many times we find ourselves acting like those Pharisees, wagging our fingers at others instead of embracing them with the love and compassion of Jesus. And I really believe that's true. It will never go away in spite of our attempts to make it go away. It brings to mind the beginning of the public ministry of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, when he visited the synagogue in his hometown of Nazareth. And there, on the Sabbath, he read aloud the words of the prophet Isaiah and said that these words had been fulfilled. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. The German theologian Jürgen Moltmann believes that Jesus in that moment was announcing the dawn of the Messianic era, a time of endless Sabbath, a life of endless feasting. And he goes on to describe the journey of Jesus to Jerusalem, where he suffers, as his festival procession that brings liberation to all of humanity. And we've seen a foretaste of that today in the healing of the man who had a withered hand. In the Gospel of Mark, that's what Jesus does in a synagogue on the Sabbath, right after the Pharisees had criticized his disciples for working while walking through a wheat field. It is nothing less than a glimpse of that freedom awaiting not only the man whose hand was healed, but also self-righteous, finger-wagging Christians and grain-plucking disciples and saintly Quakers and forgiven sinners like everyone here this morning, and Milton Willard, in that place where Sabbath will never end. Amen.